RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
We're continuing our series with What is Money? With Joel Robinson of Radical Investments in Wellies. And this is episode 3, and Joel is back with me again. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Good, thank you, Paul. How are you doing?
You're not too bad. I'm knowing more about money.
Well, that's good.
Thanks to this.
That's the hope.
I'm going to end up knowing more about money than I ever thought I would know, I think.
Yeah, or that you ever thought you wanted to know.
yeah, and all the other money talk we've had here at RCR as well. So it's been a real learning experience. So we've had two eps. First up was, the history of money, the big picture. Then we talked about currency last week. And now we're up to what, modern money? What is modern money?
So where we've gotten to from having gone from the history of the Romans and their gold coins to Constantinople, and the Byzantine Empire. And we talked about a couple of examples last week of interesting forms of money, stones and glass beads.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
But today is really all about modern money, or effectively kind of how we've gotten to where we are today with the fiat.
Where can you draw the line between, okay, historical money and modern money? Is there a line that you can draw?
That's a really good question. It's difficult to draw a clear line. I think, well, the clearest line you can draw to getting to what we have today is really following the end of the First World War.
Right.
But there is such significant history that played out prior to that that leads into that, that you can't really sort of, divorce it from that. You know what I mean? Like it's like the history is so relevant for how we've ended up where we are. But I guess, if you were to kind of try and draw a line, it'd really be post end of First World War is really kind of the shift into what we really have as money today.
Okay, so we know that there was a First World War, and it probably cost some nations a lot of money to fight that war. Wars are expensive, though there can be also an economic reset as well. So leading up to and then World War One, how did that change things?
Yeah, so if we go back to kind of maybe about 150 years prior, it was about 200 years prior to First World War, one of the most distinct actions really, I guess, taken in modern history was from Isaac Newton, of all people, who many people wouldn't have known, was the warden of the Royal Mint in Britain.
Oh, okay.
And one of the lesser known roles that he had or achievements or things about him. And in 1717, so it's almost, just over 300 years ago, the Brits adopted or readopted a gold standard. And kind of what followed from that really was essentially Britain's economic dominance over the rest of the world, and led to the expansion of the British Empire and, a lead through into what we have today. But basically what happened was, alongside Britain being early, other countries in Europe started adopting a gold standard about really 100 years later. So Britain did end up having quite a lead. And we entered in the late 1800s, a period of time which was known as one of the sort of great golden eras, with lots of, all sorts of technological advancements that occurred in that time frame, with the argument being that it was because most countries were operating, or most major developed countries were operating on a sound money. And at the height of it, there were about 50 developed nations that were all, using gold coins that were effectively interchangeable with one another, because the only currency exchange that was involved was one of weight, equivalent to, how the conversion between metric and imperial systems hasn't changed. It's a pain to do, but it's one that doesn't change day to day, year to year, month to month. So it's much simpler when you've got a consistent exchange rate than one that varies with all sorts of different, changes that go on, which is obviously what we have today with currency markets. So the argument being that having a simple, sound money that effectively everyone was using led to a lot of efficiencies, because you're not spending all your time thinking about, how much of my currency is it worth in theirs, and you just go ahead and exchange, and countries can you know, take tax, whatever the tax rate is, well, whether it's from British gold coins or from French gold coins, it kind of doesn't matter. It's all effectively the same. And so that just makes so much more efficiency the economy. And you can actually have more people putting their time to doing productive things rather than running currency markets, which are really not productive things at all for the society, really, if you think about it, the amount of people that are involved in that. So I guess it helps to just touch back again on why gold was used. And we mentioned it previously about, you know, really good value to weight. It's very tough to mine. It's chemically very sound. What's helpful to understand, because it relates back to modern money, is the effective inflation rate, or the rate of new gold that has been mined throughout history. And in the last 70 years, so we're kind of jumping forward, I guess, a bit, but you'd kind of assume, you know, as we go further ahead in time, we've got more technology, better ability to bring stuff up out of the ground. But what we also have is that the historic stockpile of gold is bigger than it ever was as well. And in the last 70 years, the annual increase in the supply of gold hasn't in a single year been above 2%. The last 70 years.
Wow.
And since 1900, it hasn't been above 2.6%. So it's quite a low level of creation of new gold. And we'll get to kind of what modern money is at in a bit. But that's kind of, I guess, why gold was just so heavily relied on as being a form of money. And then, of course, we had silver as well. But eventually that died a death, because what happened was most countries started, or banks started, to allow people to deposit their gold. Because you imagine, you know, it's nice to have somewhere safe that you can put your money, that you're not going to be robbed by your neighbors. And obviously that's a problem with gold, because it's physically obvious, it's heavy, it's large, especially if you've got any real wealth in it. And you know, you run a risk of having a big amount of your wealth stored physically at your home or at your business. And so there's a desire to have it stored somewhere safe. And what that led to was an increasing centralization of where gold was held. So rather than, you know, being stored across millions of homes or hundreds of thousands of homes, it's now stored at thousands or hundreds of banks. And so you have a greater concentration of where the money is. And that, alongside technological developments that happened in the late 1800s, which was the telegraph and train transportation in particular, it actually enabled countries to, or banks, to have a much more complicated settlement system than was ever previously possible, and thus kind of led to the paper money,
right? Yeah,
development that we see today. Because back then, you could rely on, you know, the bank would be issuing a check or a paper money that was 1-to-1 backed by the gold that you had there, and there was good systems in place ensuring that people's deposits were fairly backed. And of course, in the day, you know, if you had 100 people doing transactions between different banks, well, they could between them work out who owed who what, but basically transport whatever necessary physical gold needed to be transported in order to settle the outstanding transactions. And you have
why they needed armored cars.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, exactly. Yeah. You can see all sorts of interesting issues and opportunities that come with that. And over time, basically, there was just so much pressure to adopt a gold standard like this, that every country that was slow to do it basically got left behind economically. And it's interesting of note, and this is probably more my ponderings than it being a definitive fact, but two of the three last countries to adopt, to leave a silver type standard behind, was India and China.
Oh, okay.
And it could be argued that, well, two things. One, why they ended up being economically behind for a large stretch of time, because they were, the value of their currency was backed by silver. Silver was depreciating compared to gold. Countries that had lots of gold supplies effectively have more wealth, kind of like a bit more modern version of the glass beads, really, we talked about last week. And And additionally, I suspect that's why Chinese and Indian culture heavily values gold today, because it's something that's culturally been passed down because of what happened essentially to them economically in the early 1900s. That's my theory.
Yeah, we've heard. No, I think something there, because China's been accumulating gold big time.
Yes. Well, they and the States, which is interesting. You know, we've departed from this gold standard, but you know, a lot of these countries are still, especially in the last 20 years or so, have returned to acquiring gold a lot, which we'll kind of get to. But yeah, that's, I guess, the precursor really to what happened to get us to where we are today. You can imagine, as more and more centralization of wealth occurs, especially with a government having involvement, so it ended up with the creation of central banks, then there's this temptation of, well, you know, we've got all this wealth here, people trust us. The British pound started being basically viewed as good as gold. It was a dangerous, you know, slope to start going down, but it's what happened. And so then the Brits say, oh, yeah, we can maybe just create a little bit more of a currency because people view it as effectively as good as gold. And, you know, it's an opportunity for us as a nation to increase our political influence and economic power. And, of course, once one country starts doing it, there's temptations for others too as well. And when the First World War came about, 1914, there had already begun a bit of this kind of devaluation of currency going on through money printing.
Yeah.
But of course, when you think about a war, there's kind of two ways you can fund a war. One is through taxes. The other is through creating money. Well, you think about what's probably more popular with people to propose. Hey, we're going to collect some taxes from you to fund our war. You might not believe in it, but we want some money because we think this is the best thing for our nation. Versus, we're not taking anything from you. We're just going to, you know, create the money that's needed to fund it, and it doesn't require any cost to you. Of course, there's always a cost.
I think I know which one I'd take.
Yeah.
And while people believe in it, that works.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, while people have no major issue with it, enough to basically revolt against it. But yeah, as you can imagine, you know, in war at the time, the country's focus is very much on something else other than what's going on monetarily. And so, yeah, the easy solution was the popular one, which obviously has some significant consequences. And it'd be interesting to play out, and you could never know for certain, but be interesting to play out if they had instead gone, each country had instead gone the route of funding it through tax. You can probably expect that the war would have lasted a lot shorter.
Yeah.
Because people would start losing, you know, interest and buy-in, and it ends up winding up and probably could have meant the death of a whole lot less people in it, and significant change in where we are today, actually. But that's moot. That's what happened.
Just thinking back to what you said about gold and how, you know, different currencies were interchangeable because of the weight, the synergy of weight, let's say.
Yep.
Because we're all talking about, you know, global currencies now. That essentially meant that gold was a global sort of one world currency. If it was weight, and that's all that mattered, and purity, obviously, then that was a global currency right then. That didn't really matter what country the coin was from.
Effectively, yes. Yeah. I mean, countries had the choice of what they did to change their currency, and their choices of, you know, what they do tax-wise in their own country, but most were incentivized not to do anything radically stupid because they would just end up going behind against other countries. So, yeah, effectively that was more of a one world currency of sorts than what we currently have, in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways we kind of do have that today with the US dollar and how integral it is for virtually every currency. But we'll get to that. We'll get to that. So yeah, we had World War One.
Yep.
That initial debasement of currency, the debasement being when the printing of the paper money is more than the actual stock of gold, or the the stock of whatever's backing up the currency. And you get to the end of the war, and obviously what you've had is, you know, 5 years of creation of currency with no buying at all of gold to kind of back that currency.
Right. Yeah.
And you've got a lot of countries that have done the same thing. The issue is, okay, how do we, where do we go from here? Because if they decide, okay, we're going to re-peg it to the gold.
All the paper money devalues.
Yes. And you have an immediate recession. Because right.
No
just
one
such
likes
a,
that.
Such, well, yeah. It's not popular, right? That's certainly not popular. It's a big economic shock. The person that does that arguably does the brave thing, and the thing that, that I believe probably would have been better historically for those countries. But the short-term history would have seen him as a idiot, as a, you know, it would have been viewed as one of the, you know, worst people in history.
Yeah.
And it would only be in long-term history that people look back and go, actually, that was a really tough decision, a brave one that looked stupid, but was actually a good decision. And yeah. So, but that's not what happened. What happened was countries thought, okay, well, we need to try and move forward. How do we move forward without doing something that's really unpopular for us? And it's interesting to note at the same time that with Switzerland famously being neutral, they actually stayed on a gold standard, and is arguably why they were and still are really such an economic powerhouse for their size, is their currency actually significantly increased in value relative to especially the losers, you know, Austria and Germany. Their currencies were hugely devalued as the losers.
Well, people were turning up with wheelbarrows of money just to buy loaves of bread, I think is the common historical memory from that period, Weimar Republic, right? So, yeah, that must have been horrible time.
You know? I mean, we can scarcely, you know, for those of us that are fortunate to have only lived in developed nations, we can scarcely believe something like that to be true or what it would feel like. But yeah, that was reality. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of countries that have gone through that since World War One. Really interesting stat. I digress a little bit here, but a really interesting stat is that prior to World War One, there, and of course, historic records back to, you know, early AD and BC are somewhat patchy at best in places, but there was only one known incidence of hyperinflation prior to the First World War, hyperinflation being increase in prices of 50% or more. Between World War One and 2016, 56 incidences of hyperinflation.
There you go, yeah. And hyperinflation, how do you describe hyperinflation? How much does it have to go up each time?
50% or more in 1 year.
Okay, I got it. Yeah, I think you just said that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So it's, yeah, you know, there's many countries around the world that have gone through this. I mean, recent examples of Argentina, Colombia, Venezuela. We're fortunate enough in New Zealand that we've never had 50%. We've had around 20%.
Yep.
So not quite at hyperinflation.
I think Zimbabwe well had, you know, like, what was it, $1 trillion note or something incredible like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is kind of funny to laugh at as an outsider and you know, and look back on, and hopefully economically they'll be in a state in, you know, in decades to come where they can look back on that and laugh. But yeah, it's brutal for those going through it, unfortunately. And
well, look what it led to, the German example, that led to the rise of Nazism.
Well, that's
and
fair,
ultra-nationalism because of the desperation born out of that.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very, very fair argument to make. And, of course, World War II was historically very significant on multiple levels.
Mm.
But, yeah, out of World War II came the Bretton Woods Agreement, which is somewhat known, but basically where the victors came together and decided, what are we going to do monetarily? We've got currency issues. They had tried to basically use the US and UK, or the UK pound, British pound, and the US dollar as sort of reserve currencies post-World War One. The Brits, because they had expanded their monetary supply so much, they'd thought, they'd hoped, well, if people, other countries are needing to buy our pound, that kind of helps soak up some of this money creation that we've done to kind of get us back on track. But of course, the world's not full of easily duped people. And there were countries out there thinking, no, actually, I'd rather have gold than the British pound, because gold is actually better to have than the British pound. And so, you know, there was, I guess, an acceptance that the world wasn't going to be able to operate on the same sort of system as it had in the intervening period between the wars. But they kind of tried to do something fairly similar, where the agreement effectively was the US dollar is now sort of world reserve currency. The US dollar is going to be effectively pegged to gold, but please don't try and redeem your gold. And the other currencies basically reserve, use the US dollar as a reserve. So effectively, all, you know, all world currencies being supposedly pegged to gold by being pegged to the US dollar. And there was some attempt to try and fix interest rates between currencies and between the US dollar. But of course, when you've got multiple different central banks from different countries trying to do their own thing, there's all sorts of effects on value of currencies, and any attempt to try and fix some sort of rate is really a bit preposterous. So then you have the establishment of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, followed that, which was really an attempt to basically try and coordinate different central banks to work together to bring some level of stability, rather than just having a gold standard, which effectively achieved the same thing. All in the name of control, really, or the ability for exerting power, political influence.
Yeah.
You don't really get that with a gold standard, because it's simple and straightforward.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting, isn't it? And the British, they were basically broke at the end of World War II, weren't they? They were just spent.
Yep.
And their biggest debt was to the US, as I understand it. So they had no real power at all, did they?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's really a byproduct of what happened with World War One, all the expenditure, you know, that occurred, the debasement of their own currency. Interestingly, the UK and US had quite a relationship, obviously, and there's a lot of argument made that the US basically effectively unintentionally engineered the Great Recession that they went through as part of Britain's sort of relationship with them to try and basically save their own currency. But obviously it didn't end up really yielding anything of any fruit for the UK. And effectively that was really the ending point of the dominance of the British Empire. It's quite amazing.
They ended up only paying it back like a decade or two ago, that debt, you know.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And now we've got a system where essentially the power was shifted to the US, who effectively has the ability to expand their money supply as they like, and every other country effectively just has to take it to a certain degree, because so much of the reserves backing their currency is the US dollar. And so in 1971, the whole trying to, link the US dollar to the gold standard, to gold, became a problem, because there were some countries wanting to repatriate their gold. Actually, sorry, that's an important part I skipped over, was that as part of the agreement of Bretton Woods, that all of these central banks would basically ship their gold to the US to hold. And so over time, countries started to think, well, actually, we'd rather have that gold, please. And the US wasn't that fond of sending that back to those countries.
No.
And so then 1971, Nixon, ends the gold standard. And that's really kind of, I guess, the next phase of money, coming back to your initial question, which is where we are now, really, which is the period of government-issued fiat currency, where there is no real backing. But actually, technically, all currencies are somewhat backed, because the US Federal Reserve does still own a lot of gold, very, very fractional compared to the value of its currency.
Yeah.
Very minimal. And obviously, by extension, every other country that owns US dollars reserving their own currency has some form of backing, but it is nowhere near what it was you know, at the height of the gold standard of really a one-to-one backing. So, yeah, it's changed a lot.
And that's where fractional banking comes into it. And I don't know if you want to get into that now or that's our next episode. Perhaps it's our next episode because that's where things kind of get a little crazy, isn't it? Because you only a certain proportion of the currency is actually real money. Have I got that right?
Yeah, that's we'll perhaps save some of that conversation because that's potentially a bit of a long one. But yes, so what we've come to is a point where basically governments have quite an ability to control and influence money supply. The stated intent is for people's betterment and benefit, and regardless of what your view is on whether that's true or not, I guess the core issue it comes down to is it's incredibly difficult for any group of any people to be sufficiently informed, sufficiently quick enough to make good enough decisions for a global money supply or even a money supply for their whole country. It's just so difficult. I mean, you just see it here in people's frustration, I guess, with the Reserve Bank and changing of of lending rates, people that are involved in real estate or mortgage broking, and quite often the response is one that they don't know what they're doing or they're not doing it quick enough, etc. And so I guess therein really lies the core issue, regardless of what whether the intent is for good or bad. It's kind of a bit of a moot point in my view.
Yeah, and the risk there is that if you've borrowed money that doesn't actually exist and you can't pay back, that money that doesn't exist can be turned into your hard asset being substituted for that money. And maybe that's where we kind of leave off for now and start off next week. But that's where we're at the moment. That's where we've arrived at right now. Is that the case?
Yeah.
In money?
Perhaps go through some stats and then close off with a interesting quote, which I think people might find fascinating. So I mentioned earlier about the increase in the supply rate of gold. And annually, 2.6% is the highest it's increased in 1 year since 1900. With modern money, the New Zealand dollar, between 1990 and 2015, it averaged about 6.78% per annum increase in supply. The US, 5.45%. But prior to those periods, it was a lot higher. You'd remember, Paul, with higher interest rates and higher inflation.
We had a higher
money supply. And interestingly, the sort of money supply rate growth we have now is pretty close to what it effectively has been historically with silver.
Okay.
Having lost out to gold. Interesting food for thought.
Mm.
And developing countries have often had a much, much higher creation rates, which has led to that instability for likes of Zimbabwe, etc. So with gold much lower, but I guess in where we're heading to in some of the future episodes, especially 5 and 6, is with Bitcoin. And the creation rate of Bitcoin is much lower again, even than gold. So some food for thought. But I'll perhaps close off with this thought, which was from Friedrich Hayek, who's a famous Austrian economist, was basically in opposition to Keynes, the Keynesian economics that is mostly taught around the world today. And there's a quote. He said, "I don't believe we shall ever have a good money again before we take the thing out of the hands of a government. That is, we can't take it violently out of the hands of government. All we can do is some sly roundabout way introduce something that they can't stop."
And we know what that might be.
Potentially.
And that's what we're heading to. Okay, Joel, fascinating again. And thanks for coming back on. That was episode 3 of What is Money? So next week, we're going to be where? So people can get ready for it.
Yeah, so next week it's looking at what could be the future of money.
Okay, yeah, the future of money. What is money and the future of money? Joel Robinson, Radical Investments. We'll see you in a week, all right?
Thanks, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.